Quick warning before we get into the celebrations. There can be some swear words and adult concepts in these episodes, so make sure there's no kids around and maybe pop on some headphones. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Rights for Women Book Launch Podcast. I'm Pamela Cook, author, podcaster, and writing coach and mentor. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is a story about an orphan child, a lifelong friendship, and an impossible promise, now available at online retailers and through my website at pamelacook.com.au.
And I'm Kel from Rights for Women, the other half. I'm a podcaster and wannabe author. My business is Listen Up Podcasting, and we make podcasts for a positive world, like this one. You can find me at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or catch me on Facebook or Twitter.
As many of you will know, with the advent of coronavirus and lockdowns, authors with new releases have been unable to promote their books at live events. Here at Rights for Women, we want to help authors celebrate their new releases and help readers discover new books, all of which are available online at retailers and through independent bookstores. We'll be releasing these mini-sode chats with authors regularly throughout the coming months while we're all in isolation, and authors need a place to launch their books.
Please share the love by letting your reading friends know about the podcast and the books on social media, and by reviewing any books you read to help authors get the word out. This is a great time to put some new books on your shelf, virtual and physical, and to share the gift of reading.
Hi, my name is Sarah Brill. My book was published this year, Symphony for the Man. I'm going to do a little reading now. This is just the last couple of pages from the first part of the book. When Harry opens his eyes again, he's lost stars, he's lost his way. It's dark and cold and he's not sure where he is. He can't hear the ocean, can't hear anything. He doesn't feel uncomfortable though. Sure, it's cold. The ground beneath him is like an ice block. But he doesn't hurt anywhere. He feels no pain. And then there's something warm. At first he can't work out where it's coming from. Just something warm that makes him feel good and cozy. It's piss, his piss, running down his leg. Harry comes to realise this. He doesn't care. He feels good and warm, and that's all that matters. And then there's a voice that ruins it all. You're an accident waiting to happen, you are. Harry moves his head to try to see where the voice is coming from. An accident waiting to happen. Harry turns to see Boots near his head. Bloody brine. Harry closes his eyes. He doesn't want to see bloody brine, does he? Harry opens his mouth to speak, but it's all dry and rough and he can't get any words out. Bloody Brian reaches down with his big hairy arms and suddenly Harry is on his feet. Harry stumbles a little until he regains his balance. An accident? Fuck off. Harry's got his voice back. He feels the last of his piss run down his leg, but that warm, good feeling is gone. He tries to focus on Bloody Brian standing before him. He tries to think of a way out of the situation. I hate me brother and me sister. Actually, Harry hasn't thought about his brother and sister for a long time, but it's the only thing he can think to say. Bloody Brian likes it when you talk. He likes to know what you're thinking. He says it again. I hate me brother and me sister. If he can keep Bloody Brian talking, then perhaps the inevitable can be avoided a little longer. Do you, mate? Bloody Brian has Harry by the arm now and is starting to make him walk. You won't be distracted. You could have died out there tonight, mate, you know that? Bloody Brian isn't standing so close now. He's noticed the piss. But he's still walking, Harry, still leading him on to a place Harry prefers not to go. Don't care. They're stumbling up the street now. That's what's unusual about me. I don't care. Harry collapses his legs in an attempt to sit on the ground. But Bloody Brian is a strong man, much stronger than Harry, and he pulls him back to his feet. Harry gives in. He walks with Bloody Brian stumbling along the uneven path, allowing Bloody Brian to do what Bloody Brian feels he was born to do. He calls it helping. Harry calls it interfering. It feels like to Harry they walk forever with Bloody Brian going on about some bloke called John Howard and how he changed the rules and made all this work for Bloody Brian, how he doesn't have time to be picking Harry up off the ground. Harry doesn't know who John Howard is, but he hears his name a bit. It seems like a lot of people are mad at him. He would have thought Bloody Brian would be happy with more work, more people out on the street to save, but Bloody Brian seems pretty pissed off about it. Then all too soon they are there. The lights are too bright and the room already stinks like piss and booze, dirty washing. There's something else too, another smell worse than all those others that Harry can't place. And then he's lying in a bed and Bloody Brian has gone. Harry thinks he'll just lie there a little time and once Bloody Brian has forgotten him, once he's moved on to the next poor bastard, then he'll leave. Harry wakes up in the shelter. He wakes up stinking and swearing with a head beside him.
Thank you, Sarah. That was it's a really powerful excerpt that you read, and I'm really interested to hear more about the book. But before we get to that, could you tell us a little bit about your writing history and how you came to sort of be here now writing this particular book?
Yeah, sure. I started writing when I was 15. I was a high school student and I started writing plays. At the time, Australia had this great supportive playwriting network for young playwrights. So I became part of that and I wrote plays really from the age of 15 to the age of 30. I was involved in theatre writing and I loved it a lot. I'd also, in my later years of playwriting, I'd started to write a lot of monologue. And I remember someone I was working with say to me, look, you've got to start writing dialogue or you've got to move to prose.
Okay.
And I did want to write a book. I had started working on a book when I was about 21, a short novella that Spinifex published in 2002 called Glory. When that book was published, so I was around 30 then when that book was published, and I had all the scraps of ideas for Symphony for the Man, but I hadn't actually got around to putting it together. I was still working on theatre. But I thought with the book coming out, I should write another one. So I started on Symphony for the Man. I wrote that first draft. In 2001, 2002, we were overseas, but we came back to Australia. And then I had my first child and two more after that.
Yeah.
Everything kind of stopped.
Yeah.
The playwriting has completely stopped. I really have not got back to that. But I find with the children I'm still able to write prose. So I've continued to write prose. And with the young children I continue to work on Symphony for the Man. It took a long time for me to get it to a place where I wanted to start showing it to people.
Mm.
But I got there in the end.
That's great. So it's been a real long-term sort of labour of love for you, this particular book.
Yeah, it's older than my first child.
That's great. Yeah. And have you been working, like were you working on other things as well at the time or you just sort of really put all your writing energy into Symphony for the Man?
Look, before kids, I was working on a short film and I was working on this book and I was working on a play. After kids, really, it was just Symphony for the Man. I think I'd look at plays every now and then, but I just really found I didn't have the space in my life that playwriting requires just to hold all those voices and such as precise art.
Right.
Novel writing was really, I just had to have that one voice in my head. I was able to do that with the children, so it was something that I could continue as I was with them and something I've, continued now. And as I get older, I'm writing more and more, but I am still just writing prose.
Yeah. What was that transition like from writing plays to writing novels, like apart from, you know, as you say, you really can focus on the one particular voice from your protagonist, but what were the other sort of changes that you had to make, I guess, to your style and your knowledge base about writing as well?
I naturally write first person, present tense.
Okay.
That is my natural inclination.
Right.
And I think that comes from playwriting.
Yeah.
And so with Symphony for the Man, that's how it was originally written. It's written from the female character's point of view in first person and it was present. But as the drafts continued, I wanted to change that. So it's still pretty present tense, but I moved to third person, which was really quite freeing.
Okay.
But a bit of work for me because it's not something natural that I do. So it was a whole new draft of moving to third person where I got to be almost a different character and comment on my character, see them from above or from outside.
Yeah, another perspective. Yeah.
Inside.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're working on something like over quite a long period of time like that, and obviously you're quite attached to it and to the characters, at what point did you sort of think, oh, I now need to get some outside help with it, you know, to get somebody else to read it or to send it to an editor? Or what was that part of the process like for you?
That's kind of I guess that's a real difference between playwriting and prose writing for me, is that playwriting, I would get that play out pretty quickly because it's such a collaborative medium.
Mm.
And with the books, I've found that it's really not that I rely on myself for a long period of time. Not many people had read, I think about four or five people read Symphony for the Man before it was published. So the publishers and the editor, the film producer who optioned it, and my sister, you know, that was pretty much all the people that read it. I didn't feel the need to show it around. I really felt like I just needed to get it right for myself.
Yeah.
But then, of course, I mean, Spinifex had a lot of feedback, a lot of really great feedback. They didn't initially accept the book. They asked for some pretty significant changes.
Okay.
Which took me another year or so to do because I was working on a different manuscript at the time. But I was quite happy with that process, that it was really just the publishers, the editor, and I reading the book together.
Yeah. And was Spinifex, because you'd worked with them before, were they, you know, your first port of call when you were thinking of looking for a publisher?
What I did this time, Spinifex were fabulous with Glory. And then this time I thought, I'm busy, I was doing a master's, had the three kids. I thought, I'll just get an agent and let the agent take care of this so I don't have to think about it. And I did get an agent, but the agent, it didn't work out. She'd shown it to one publisher and then really didn't show it anywhere else. And I had suggested sending it to Spinifex, but she didn't think that was appropriate for this book. So when I got towards the end of my master's and I could think again about other things, I parted with that agent and then sent it to Spinifex. And that, they were my first call after the agent didn't work out.
Yeah, you'd had that previous experience with them and then made the changes, and then, of course, they ended up publishing the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And could you tell us a little bit about the book itself in terms of, you know, your main character, Harry, and obviously not in an ideal situation there, just even based on the excerpt that you read out for us. So could you tell us a bit about the plot Harry?
Yep. The book is set around 1999, so just before the Olympics in Bondi, or in Sydney, but the book is set in Bondi. Harry is a homeless man who's a long-time resident of the streets of Bondi. He has a particular bus stop that he lives in sleeps in just before Bondi Junction. And the story starts, it's a two-character story, really. The female character, who's not named in the book, is on a bus, and she passes by Harry's bus stop and sees him sleeping there, and she is quite a lost character. She doesn't really have huge direction in her life. She's quite isolated from the community. She's not far behind Harry, really. She's just kind of hanging on to her apartment in terms of her financial security. And when she sees Harry, she feels a need to do something for him. And she decides to write a symphony for him without having really any musical knowledge.
Oh, wow.
About how to write a symphony.
Yeah.
So that starts her journey on learning about symphonies. And during that journey, she introduces Harry to symphonic music, which starts him off on a separate little journey around one specific symphony that mm-hmm. she provides for him. And, yeah, it's about how music sort of enhances their lives.
And their relationship, I imagine, developing throughout the course of the book.
There is a, yeah, look, it's not a close relationship, but it's a relationship that develops.
Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting storyline. So where did the inspiration come from, Sarah, in terms of, you know, the music and the homelessness, that sort of thing?
Look, the music was a pretty random thought.
Yeah.
But I love the the relationship between a symphony and a novel. You know, I felt they were quite closely related if you look at music and writing. I liked the classic structure of the symphony in four parts, how prescriptive it is in some ways, but also quite free. You know, I mean, they're all so different. The homelessness is a topic that I've always been interested in and something I was observing at the time in the late 90s. My recollection, although I'm struggling to find proof for this recollection, but I'm sure it's there, I'm sure I'm right, but John Howard came in and he changed some funding structures or some laws around mental health that meant there are a lot more people on the street, but after hospital foundation, there was nowhere else for them to go once they were out of the hospital system.
I remember that. I remember what you're talking about. There were changes to sort of halfway homes and things, I think, where people were, ended up being a lot more people were homeless as a result,
So I had that in my mind, and then, you know, the Olympics were coming and Bondi, I got cleaned up for the visitors. So that was also there. And then the process that drew it all together was a workshop with Kate Grenville.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I know. I was working in the city 3 days a week. I was working and 2 days a week I was writing, and I saw that Kate was doing this workshop and I jumped on it. You know, who wouldn't?
She's such a fabulous writer. Yeah.
And it was a fabulous series of workshops. We went once a week. I can't remember how long. And the process of that workshop was to grab snippets from your life, bits of dialogue. So the excerpt I read, a few of those pieces of dialogue were pieces that I heard out on the street that I grabbed. I grabbed lots of other bits, and then in Kate's workshop we ordered them into beginning, middle and end.
Okay.
What we liked, what we felt like a beginning, what felt like a middle, what felt like an end.
Yeah, yep.
From that, I constructed this story.
Fantastic. And do you have a musical background yourself?
Not really. I mean, I can play the piano. I can play a bad version of the release.
I think I can do that too.
I can read a little bit of music. I know how to play a scale.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah. So it must have been quite a learning process for you too in terms of the symphony idea, and then, of course, also the research into, you know, the social situation for your characters.
Yes. Look, I spent more time, I think I'd observed and read newspaper articles for so long about homelessness that was all there, but I spent a lot of time reading about symphonies. I went and did a course on the structure of a symphony. You know, I tried to speak to any musician I could find that knew about that area.
Yep. And can you tell us a little bit about Harry in terms of his character? Obviously he is in a, you know, this not ideal situation being on the streets, but he seems like, just from the excerpt you read, he's got a mind of his own and quite a character. Can you tell us a little about him?
Sure. Harry, Harry isn't, an age isn't put on him in the book, but I put him at his probably 50s, maybe early 50s. He's been on the street a long time. He has a few routines and patterns and things that he follows. So One is waiting for a woman to walk past in a pram past his bus stop. That's his thing that he waits for before he gets up in the morning. And he thinks of her as a past lover, a relationship that he left prior to being on the streets. So he confuses this woman with the other woman who he spent quite a bit of time looking for after he left, and then after she moved out of the Bondi area. He has another routine where he watches the time. So every morning between 10 and 11 a.m. he goes to Bondi Junction and he asks people what the time is. He watches that hour pass. He thinks that time is very slippery on the street and you need to lock it down in some way. So he has this routine that he does. He also has a belief that if he doesn't do that, bad things will happen. So there are some points later in the book where he doesn't, because of clock watching. He get to clock watch, and then of course he knows bad things are going to happen. Yeah. And it's the last thing about Harry is that he's an alcoholic in denial, I would think. So he says, you know, you mustn't drink on the street, it will be the death of you. But every now and then, as in that excerpt, Harry does drink.
Yeah. Did you know, you said you collected a lot of material and did a lot of reading. Did you do sort of observation or any conversations with homeless people in the course of your research for the book? Or
No, I didn't. Not currently homeless people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot out there, and I guess documentaries and things like that too are really helpful with that sort of research.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, if I were to write about homelessness now, I'd probably write about women and hidden homelessness.
Yeah.
But at that time, I was really writing about what I was seeing, and what you see is me, really.
Yeah.
Street. And it always just seemed to me such a fixable problem. You know, every year they release that figure of how many people are homeless. And I think for a country like Australia, it's not that many. Really, yeah. It was political will. It's not that many to do something about.
It was amazing how they could round up all the homeless people to get them off the streets during COVID.
Yes.
And then put them all back out again. Yeah. And is there anything else, Sarah, about the book itself that you'd like listeners to know?
The book, the only other thing I can think of is that the book focuses on one particular symphony, and that's Beethoven's Third Symphony, called the Eroica. It's an anniversary for Beethoven this year. Is it 200 years since his birth? Something like that. And it's a beautiful piece of music. They say that it's his best. I listen to it a lot.
What was it like for you, you know, seeing the book? I'm imagining you, after all of that time of spending writing it and nurturing it, you know, getting it to publication stage, what was it like for you when you first held that book in your hand?
Oh, so nice. I mean, it's such a beautiful looking book.
It's gorgeous.
Just do so well with covers. It's a strange thing when you work full time and you've got family and just kind of moving through. I picked up the box of books at the post office before I went to do the grocery shopping.
Yeah.
And I knew I had this box of books, and the post office lady, you know, just handed it over like a box, and I wanted to tell her that this wasn't a box, but she was busy and had no interest. But I ran into someone I knew in the shop, and I just tapped my box.
Yay.
The box and looked at it, and it was really lovely. And
I
think then I just moved on to work and life, and a little while later I looked in my cupboard and I had these two books with Glory there too, two pink spine books, which is the Spinifex way, and that was a really proud moment.
I'm sure that's fantastic.
The film producer who's optioned the book.
Oh yes, tell us about that.
So that's Spark Plug Films. They've optioned the book. Mark was one of the first people to read it after the publishers, and he really liked the story. We had a chat to him on the weekend. They're up to the first draft.
Fantastic. Will you have any input into that with your playwriting experience? Or
look, I didn't. I asked to read the scripts just for my own kind of learning process, but yep. I won't be involved in the writing of it. It's just been too long for me.
Script
writing to think that I could really do it, and time-wise, I don't think that I have the capacity.
Yeah.
But I'll certainly be there observing how they go. And Mark and I had a long conversation about character backstories, and he had a whole list of questions. So
okay.
Certainly involved in terms of informing them of what I think the book is about, the character's about, and how that then informs them to read up.
Great. Hmm. Oh, all the best with that. That sounds really exciting. It's such a great thing to be able to see your story then transformed into another, you know, format and being brought to life. Yeah.
It's a really lovely feeling to have him kind of believe in the story and wanting to spend time on it. Was a really lovely feeling when it was so long just with me and in my head. And I really wasn't sure. It felt like a very little story, and I wasn't sure anyone would really be interested in it.
Mm.
So that was really nice.
A little story but deals with very big issues.
Yeah.
Universal issues. So. And what are you working on now, Sarah? You mentioned you were working on another manuscript.
Yeah. So I'm working on a coming-of-age story at the moment. I'm in second draft of that. It's really fun.
Yeah.
Really enjoying, working on something a bit lighter.
Could you tell us, before we finish up, could you tell us what you're reading at the moment or any book recommendations apart from Symphony for the Man that you would recommend people
recommend people. I am reading Imbi Nimi's The Spill. Imbi and I went to high school together, so that's what I'm reading at the moment. And prior to that, I just finished A Single Man, which I loved. I haven't read a book like that for a while.
Oh, thank you for those recommendations. That's excellent. And also, just before we go, where would you recommend people go to look for Symphony for the Man if they would like to read it?
The best place to buy the book is the Spinifex website.
Okay.
Yep. I think that's easiest, but also go to your local bookstore. They'd be able to get it in.
Yeah.
Ask for it at your local library.
Yes, definitely. Okay, fantastic. Thank you for chatting to us. It's been lovely to hear about the book and just the evolution of the story and how it's all come together. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Book Launch and supporting our authors. If you like what you hear, check us out at rightsforwomen.com, where you can find all our regular episodes and our new book launch episodes, and help us help authors by supporting us at Patreon for just a few dollars each month. You can find out more about all of this on our website.
And don't forget to subscribe to Rights for Women wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, can you please give us a quick rating and review so other people can find us and these awesome books that authors are launching in isolation right now?
Happy reading.
This podcast episode was recorded, produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.